Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper on October 21st, 2018.
You say that as if it's...
Well, it's a big day. Happy birthday, Noelle Borg.
Oh, that's true.
She's hitting a milestone today.
What? I don't dare ask, but good.
Well, just, you know, we don't have to, you know...
Divulge,
yes. But yes. So happy birthday, Noelle.
All right, good.
Okay.
Good for
And it also, a lot of anniversaries around now.
What's that?
In my family. I mean, we had our anniversary last week,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And also, my sister Sarah and her husband Bill have an anniversary on October 20th. And then October 22nd, my brother Bryce and Lorna, his wife, have an anniversary. So three out of four of my siblings.
Must be the month to get married.
Well, it's a beautiful time of year. It's a beautiful time to have a birthday or an anniversary or whatever.
It's a nice day.
It's not so beautiful here.
It's nice. It's chilly. And what does that mean?
Still no fall color.
You know what it means? It means baseball. It means baseball playoffs. The sport meant to be played in summer. Extends, for financial reasons, now out well into the fall, into the beginning of November, I believe. But in any case... We're just about to start the World Series, and we've been treated to the spectacle of watching these playoff teams winnow down.
Well, who's in the World Series? The Dodgers?
Dodgers and the Red Sox.
So is that good for the market or whatever?
Which market is that?
The people, how many people will watch?
Yeah.
Are people interested in the Dodgers and the
no,
Red Sox?
But those are big cities, and that's what matters. LA is a big population. They are traditional baseball teams. They've been around for a long time. It's a sexy matchup for, you know.
Okay. All right. So you said no, but I think you meant yes.
yeah, that's my way. So in any event, but here's the problem with the chilly weather. The chilly weather is that during the games, the managers and the players who aren't in the game are wearing sweatshirts, and somebody in MLB marketing figured this out. And as a result, they have naturally, because that's the way the world goes, designed the sweatshirts for a maximum competitive commercial advantage. And what you have is a bunch of players wearing horrible sweatshirts. Horrible sweatshirts. Who is this writing this? And this is Jason Gay of the Wall Street Journal observes that the, how does he put it? He puts it, these sweatshirts are now a post- baseball postseason tradition, like trying to find TBS with a remote, which you know is a problem. they're shabbily designed with painful fragments of inspirational sayings. They seem concocted to go straight to a yard sale that's waiting to happen. And they look awful. But what's worse than the fact that they look awful, Tamsin, is the concept behind it. Because, let me explain. Let me give you an example.
I thought you were going to talk about, when you told me you were going to talk about ugly sweatshirts, I thought you were going to talk about the spectators at a Phillies game.
No, I'm not talking
because
about spectators.
You have a lot of ugly sweatshirts.
Those people can't help it.
Okay.
But this is like the greatest marketing minds in baseball have come together to design these awful sweatshirts. And here's what's awful about them. Because if it's possible, they have dumbed down something even more than it was dumbed down before. And here's what I mean. The Boston Red Sox sweatshirt says on it, do damage. Okay? Do damage. It doesn't really do much, doesn't really say much, but they have to explain themselves. That's the problem. The Houston Astros, it says, never settle, right? It sounds cribbed from an ad for white wine in a box, as Jason Gay says. But, I mean, never settle, what does that mean? The Milwaukee Brewers, our crew, our October, that's their slogan. But this is the one that really gets me. The Dodgers are wearing sweatshirts that say determined. And what bothers me about that is, you should be able to tell if they're determined from the way they play.
Ah.
But the idea that you can't trust people to figure out if people are determined or will never settle or will do damage, you can't tell by watching the game. If it's on their sweatshirt, it clues you in as to whether they're determined or not.
So this goes totally with my theory that baseball is a stupid game. Because last week we talked about how baseball has been crafted.
Yeah.
The rules and everything are crafted now to make it more boring and less interesting to the spectators. Now we have these silly sweatshirts. it just gets dumber and dumber.
Yeah, well, it's not.
It's your sport, buddy. Your sport.
It's not the rules. It's the changes in the game have been designed to
really
in a way that doesn't make the game more interesting. Yeah, well, you know what? The last thing I'll say about baseball.
Give me that old time baseball.
They had one of those games that they said instant classic. It was like Wednesday night. You know what it was classic about that game? Everything that happened between midnight and 1 a.m. That was the fabulous stuff. Who's watching that? People related to the players? I don't know. But they have problems.
Oh, all right. It's much too late for the octogenarians who still are interested in baseball.
It's a game for children. You want children to watch the game. That's your next generation of viewers.
Apparently
all right,
not.
Everything's going to heck in a handbasket. So there are three articles about DNA. DNA, when it was first brought to the...
Is that DMA?
DNA.
Oh, because you're DMA.
Yeah.
But you want to talk about DNA.
Yeah, deoxynucleic acid, if I recall correctly. But DMA, the identifying code that is going to be so useful in all kinds of ways, in terms of diagnosing diseases, in terms of...
Finding criminals.
Exactly. Well, it turns out it's kind of true and it's kind of complicated. It's not as cut and dried as we thought. All right? So let's give an example. One example is the notion that DNA is used to screen people. A person's genome is sent to a lab. And the question is, or is that person apt to fall prey to a particular disease? Do they have to be monitored for that disease? Do they have genetic mutation that's problematic? And you figure, well, you know, you'll figure it out because you get the report from the genome company who's taking a look
at
it.
Well, yeah, you get that in your 23andMe report.
You do, but here's the problem. While a person's genome doesn't change, the research linking particular bits of DNA to disease is very much in flux. Geneticists and testing labs constantly receive new information that leads them to reassess genetic mutations. So 23andMe is going to look at it and say, you have this genetic mutation. They're going to get that right. But what is not going to stay the same and may change is that while it looks benign now, a year from now, 2 years from now, researchers may say, you know, that's not benign. That's a problem. That's a link to these particular diseases. And the person who got the test results doesn't know that and will never know that and will go along thinking
so
that he
no
has
follow-up.
There's no follow-up. And as a matter of fact, it
They're
creates
not
a
on
false
some
sense
database
of security.
With 23andMe
Absolutely
that,
not.
You know, an update will go out.
So the result is, as the Times says, the gene test you had a few years ago might yield a startlingly different result now.
Okay, I get that, but we could still update the information.
And we can.
Apparently, they're not doing it.
They're
yet.
Not doing it.
But we're all new to this.
I said
brave
it's,
new world.
It's complicated.
DNA.
I didn't say it's impossible. Look, okay. let me give you my second example. I'm on a roll now on this subject. All right, You go to the crime detection thing, right? GED match. All right. Okay. What do they do? How do they even do it? It's a very small organization. It's a guy in tennis shoes, according to the Times, in a small office in Florida with his cat. But he's got a database with all these people who give him this information because they're looking for cousins, they're looking for long-lost relatives, they're doing whatever they're doing. He now has access to 17 million DNA profiles in genealogical databases, right? And now what's happening is these crime labs... And
the police go to him.
Go to him and say, help us figure this out. And he does it. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. He was, you know, there was the California killer that they tracked down, the serial killer. He's sitting there. He has no idea they're using his database when this first happens.
Uh-huh.
And he's after the fact, he's saying, oh, were they using my database? Do I have something to do with this? And his first reaction is, that's wrong. They shouldn't do that. And now he's kind of warm to it. And unlike other databases... they'll take anything and they'll give access to the crime. So as a result, crime labs are coming to them and using it to do these matches and solve these crimes. But it raises all kinds of questions of privacy, which people who are attuned to this are quite sensitive about. And they identify one group. It's a group that... is objecting because of the matches that are available it's from the Afro-American Genealogical and Historical Society. They feel that many African-Americans have been falsely accused of crimes. They do not want any of the African-American data to be used in the database because it's just going to encourage that and right of privacy, it shouldn't be used. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how this lands, I don't know, but it does raise serious issues about privacy. And a lot of people contribute to this database that don't realize that now their data is going to be used in a way that didn't intend it to be used. I understand your thinking. Your thinking is good that you're finding criminals. There's something to that. But
well, I think it's cute that it's some little back office in Florida.
It was cute. You know, it
you,
is cute.
You see all these, you can imagine all these notebooks and papers and piled up.
It's cute, but the other side of it is not like a lot of heavy thinking is being done about what are the implications of this for people's privacy and their data and the like.
Okay, so there's thinking to be done.
More thinking, that's my
more
point.
Thinking.
And here's the last one, and again, we'll put in the more thinking category. So, of course, you saw the Elizabeth Warren story this week, because Elizabeth Warren, in what I would call a questionable political move, decided that she would go out and basically rebut Donald Trump's suggestion.
He said if she would have DNA testing, he would
pay $1 million.
Yeah.
Well, let me walk through a little more slowly. So Donald Trump had called her in a derisive way Pocahontas because he said that she had claimed on various applications that she had Native American heritage.
Right.
And he said he made that offer saying he'd pay her $1 million if he was proven otherwise.
Okay.
And so she triumphantly produces test results from DNA testing and says, "I've proven it otherwise. Where's my $1 million? And Donald Trump says, "I don't remember promising you that," or whatever he says. I don't even know. But here's the point. The real question is, did she really disprove anything? And strangely, she decided to come up with a press announcement that she did disprove something, but actually probably didn't. Now, you can, but it comes back to it's complicated. It can be interpreted different ways. There was a headline in the, it turns out that the data is inconclusive, and that maybe she has some relationship to someone Native American 6 or 10 generations back. And then
but
the question is...
most of us might.
A lot of us, or as the headline in the Wall Street Journal said, quote, "We are all Native Americans now." Then there's an article here in the Times about digging deeper into it. And the answer is that there's no clear answer. It's pretty much, yeah. I mean, you can make the argument that she didn't prove very much. But also, there's even greater imprecision to it than people originally thought. And the reason is that it's not like blood types. When you mix blood, you might say, well, someone is a quarter this blood and 1/8 this blood, because the generations reflect particular blood types as you go on to various degrees. DNA, it hits or it doesn't hit.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is that you could have no trace of a particular type of DNA 3 generations down, even though you know that your grandfather was of X descent. It could be a zero. It just didn't click.
Oh, really?
That's right.
Oh, that
so,
I didn't know.
Yes. So it's very hard to put your finger on it. You're not going to be able to prove anything, especially if there's a remote connection. So the whole thing's a folly.
Yeah.
So in any event, so this stuff can be used. It can be misused. It's complicated. Nothing simple. Not that's our.
But it
theory.
Seems like it was a misstep on her part.
Well, I don't want to get into politics, but yes.
That. All right. On a lighter note.
Yeah.
Museum update, ding, 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 this time in London at the Tate Britain, an exhibition of the work of Edward Burne Jones, whom the Wall Street Journal cites as the last great artist of Victorian Britain, an acolyte of the era's literary superstars, including John Ruskin, Alfred Tennyson, and Robert Browning, and a follower of the Pre-Raphaelite group of artists. He became, for a time, a superstar himself, self-taught and hard-working, suffused with a spirituality inspired by the theologian John Henry Newman. He created a vast catalog of paintings, drawings, stained glass windows, tapestries, and furniture that typically relied on medieval and mythical themes and sources. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's going to be at the Tate Britain from October 24th to February 24th. And I bring it up because, of course, as you well know, I did my senior thesis at Princeton on a stained glass window, St. Cecilia, by Edward Burne Jones.
Oh, well.
And the article mentions here that Burne Jones is really popular when he's living. And in fact, students in the 19th century are hanging up prints of his sort of Arthurian themed images. So he's all the deal. After he dies, you know, even Virginia Woolf was even quoted as dismissing him as only kind of a glorified decorator. And his reputation kind of
where does Virginia
plummets.
Woolf get off with that kind of thing?
Well, actually, she is. She was. Her mother was one of Burne Jones's models. So, I mean,
it's even
the,
more so.
All part of that group. Burne Jones was good buddies with William Morris.
Okay.
And that whole arts and crafts movement of British art. So she dismisses him in part because he works in all these different media. That makes him kind of a decorator. Whereas Morris and his group were trying to embrace those so-called lesser arts. And actually he encouraged women, and his wife was instrumental in encouraging women to be involved in textiles and design during that period. Elevating craft.
This is Burns.
William Morris.
Oh, they were buddies.
William Morris is really the big name here, but they were buddies. William Morris was short and stout, and Edward Burne Jones was tall and thin, and he was constantly giving Morris a hard time about his appearance. Needless to say, all of Burne Jones's characters are tall and thin. But the thing is, his reputation plummets. It begins to revive, especially in America during the 70s.
Oh, when you're writing your thesis.
When I'm writing my thesis.
As a result of your
thesis.
And we're
all wild about this medieval kind of art. Yeah, it seems, you know, the whole Renaissance
period. So he's been riding the wave of your thesis ever since the 70s.
Apparently, you know. I mean, we all loved this stuff. So, you know, he worked on all kinds of things, including just decorating grand pianos. So anyway, I think it would be fun to see this
exhibition. All right, well, we will go. Did we decide we're going? Is that what we decided?
I mean, maybe we will go. It doesn't really knock my socks off now.
Okay.
You know, tastes change, and I still am fascinated.
And yet you're going to use it to
the arts and crafts
finagle
movement.
A trip to London. I can see where the way this is going. But that's fine. That's fine. We'll see some plays.
We'll see some plays. Maybe we'll, you know, make a visit to the Victoria and Albert Museum, one of the great decorative arts museums.
You're luring me in. Good.
Thanks. Oh, a little shout out while we're here to Brookdale Community College, because in the real estate section of the New York Times, they talk about living in Middletown, New Jersey, which is basically where Brookdale is, and it's even shown on the map. So that's a charming little community right by the shore, within a spinning distance of New York City. And it would be, looks like a nice place to live. It's certainly a nice place to work.
Okay.
I'm always in a bad mood when I get in the car to go to Brookdale. And by the time I'm on my way, it's such a beautiful countryside. Yeah. I feel better.
Good. Good. All right. So there are a couple of thoughtful pieces that are kind of related here. Why do I say thoughtful? Because the first one's about artificial intelligence. And I have to say, I don't know about you, but whenever people say artificial intelligence, I never know exactly what they're talking about. And it conjures up the thought of machines that think for themselves. Is it? You're nodding.
Well,
aren't you?
I remember many, many years ago, before Sadie was born, at one of my jobs, one of the women working there, her husband worked in artificial intelligence at that place across from the Princeton Junction train station.
And
I said, well, what is that?
Yeah.
And she said,
Well, that's illuminating. Thank you for that.
And that was over 30 years ago. I mean,
All right, but
I've never understood, and I assumed it was too hard to understand.
Well, you see, okay, so now we have an explanation. Here's the deal on this. As I said, I thought it just meant that machines were thinking for themselves. It's artificial intelligence. Not so. That's not what it means. This is an interview from a fellow named Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote a book called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. He's a former medieval scholar who became an expert in artificial intelligence. And so the question from the New York Times to him is, what remains the biggest misconception about AI? Answer, people confuse intelligence with consciousness. They expect AI to have consciousness, which is a total mistake. Intelligence is the ability to solve problems. Consciousness is the ability to feel things. Pain, hate, love, and pleasure. Machines don't have that.
Well, that's interesting.
It's very interesting. So then the next question, you know, can machines develop consciousness? No, only in science fiction. Do we want computers with feelings? I doubt it. I'm with him. But so it does make it a lot simpler, right? Because what is it? All they mean by artificial intelligence is MapQuest. That's artificial intelligence. It's not
what makes
consciousness.
It artificial?
Well, it's because, I don't know what makes it artificial. It's the word they use. It's because you get to ask, you don't have to ask a person, you go ask a machine. It's artificial. And we're infusing
it's artificial machines. In a different sense.
Exactly. But it's not consciousness. Okay. So it takes a lot of the spookiness out of it.
Right.
And it makes
so
it
what
seem,
was this book again?
This is called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Noah Harari.
So do you think the book is interesting? Does he seem like an interesting guy?
Yeah, yes and yes. He also wrote a book called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, a sprawling account of human history from the Stone Age to the 21st Century. You might be interested in that.
That sounds like a long book.
That sounds like a lot. But he also makes one other interesting point. He says, look, the goal of artificial intelligence is not to be perfect because you can always adjust the metrics. Artificial intelligence simply needs to do better than humans can do, which is usually not very hard. So that takes us to Tom Stoppard's new play, which, believe it or not,
talk about intelligent humans,
is about consciousness. Okay.
Okay.
So yes, Tom Stoppard, who has written a great many plays, including Arcadia, The Real Thing, The Invention of Love, brilliant playwright, and it turns out.
And travesties, of course.
So his new play is called The Hard Problem, and it tries to answer the question, what is consciousness? Okay? And it doesn't sound like an apt subject for a play.
It's not really grabbing me.
Well, but here's the deal, and here's why it's an interesting article in The Times. They say that this is basically what Stoppard sets out to do, and what he agrees he sets out to do in his
when
in
he
this
writes
interview
a play.
When he writes a play,
yeah.
He takes a difficult subject and he tries to relate it to characters and individual such that it's a play that is both illuminating and engaging. The question is how to twine all that intellectual jaw drop and ping pong wordplay, which he's known for, to story and character. How to write a play that not only makes us think but also makes us feel. That's the question, and that's the genius of Stoppard when he succeeds. The play we mentioned, he clearly succeeded. He doesn't always succeed, but he agrees that that's the point. His own quote is, an evening at the theater is an evening at a story, pretty much all the time, pretty much every time. So that's what he's setting out to do. He's quite clear on it. And what's a little discouraging about this play, perhaps, is that they do also publish a brief exchange that they had with Tom Hollander, who was the star of Travesties, we saw it on Broadway, who was on site filming something else in Belgium. And he said, yes, he had gone in to see the London production of Hard Problem, and he, quote, didn't really get it. So I think...
Ruh-roh.
And this is a guy who was into Travesties, so I wonder about that. But it's interesting about the Stoppard's process. And the final thing in terms of thinking about things is a book that's called Capitalism in America. Capitalism in America, which may not sound like a real grabber to you, but it actually, it's interesting. It's by Alan Greenspan, who was the Federal Reserve Chairman, and Adrian Woolridge, who's a columnist with The Economist. And let me put it to you this way. I think this frames the issue very well. The book starts with, as described here, a charming thought experiment. Imagine that a version of the World Economic Forum was held in 1620. Many nations would have been present, and the question is, which is going to be the dominant nation economically? China had the world's largest economy. The Ottomans were about to smash into Western Europe. The Dutch and English were ruling the oceans. France had Europe's largest economy. North America was nothing, and yet the United States would eventually become the world's biggest economy, one that still dominates. The question is, why did that happen? And yes, one answer is there are a lot of natural resources here, but that's not the answer in the view of the authors here, because it's very difficult to access those resources, and they certainly weren't immediately accessible for many hundreds of years. The answer is free enterprise, capitalism. And in a very specific way, what capitalism did was it helped create people like the railroad entrepreneurs, the people who bred horses, those entrepreneurs, the people who helped plant the crops like Eli Whitney, like Cyrus McCormick, like John Deere, who helped harvest the crops, Samuel Morse, Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, again and again and again. All those folks were able to operate in a fairly unfettered atmosphere because of free enterprise. And that's what the U.S. had as an engine that these other nations didn't have. And that's why it prevailed. Now, that may be overly simplistic, but that's the thesis. And then it takes you to, well, where are we now? Where are we now? And have we hit a point that it turns out that capitalism, free enterprise was a bad idea? And the authors, of course, say no. And without going too deeply into it, what they're really saying is it's just a matter of waiting for the next idea. I mean, yes, you may have a situation where people are saying, I wonder how this is being disruptive in terms of employment and finding new industries that employ and finding new places for people who have to go to new industries. But that will happen. That always happens. When you replace the horse and buggy with the car, that happened. When you replace the buggy whip with gasoline, that happened, and it always happens. And you can't overreact to the period when one's thinking about what's the next thing. You just want to create the atmosphere for what's the next thing. It's interesting, the guy who writes it, writes the review, is a fellow named Glaser, who's a professor of economics at Harvard, who went to Princeton, a few years younger than we are. He's a very interesting guy. He's written some very interesting books, but he's just reviewing this here. And the way he sums it up is this way. He says, readers who already believe in it, that our future depends on a dynamic free market, will have their beliefs bolstered by capitalism in America. I suspect a few millennial supporters of Bernie Sanders will read these pages and feel, well, very few will feel the scales drop from their eyes. Such conversions would require a new set of entrepreneurial heroes whose careers could help make the case for human freedom, even to those who think that social inclusion is a higher goal than economic growth. So that's the question. We're just looking for the next Samuel Morse? Maybe. That's the thesis.
Well, interesting. Because, of course, the development of free enterprise capitalism during that period, they're talking about the 16th century, had a huge impact on art as well, both in terms of subject matter and how it was created and sold, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I'm not sure I could really read the book, but...
You have another book.
You can read it and tell me about
it. Yes, well, we'll look forward to it.
Yeah, well, so here's a book. I haven't seen a review of it yet. Yeah. It just came out. But, I've been under the weather and this weekend and watched a fair amount of TV and saw a story about a new book about a woman named Eunice Hunton Carter, and it was written by her grandson Stephen Carter, who is a professor of law at Yale, and also a writer, a successful writer. Here's the title of the book: "Invisible: The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Brought Down America's Most Powerful Mobster." So I'm not terribly interested in biographies of lawyers or interested in mobsters, but this sounded pretty interesting. And Eunice Carter, his grandmother, born in 1899, becomes the first female African-American ADA,
Assistant District Attorney,
right, in New York, in the 1930s, right? She is actually part of the task force of under Thomas Dewey, who, will become governor and will run for president, et cetera, who takes down Lucky Luciano.
Lucky Luciano, we all know. Yes.
Yeah, and she ends up in his group, and because she's a woman, she's assigned prostitution, and she finds...
Well, she's not assigned prostitution, she's assigned the prostitution crime unit, but yes. Gotcha.
Okay. All right. All right. And so she actually finds the links between prostitution and Luciano and helps to...
Well, she follows the money.
She follows the money. Right. Exactly. She's born in Atlanta, and her parents are both college educated. Hmm. Her father is the founder of the Black Division of the YMCA. Her mother's involved with the YMCA, the NAACP. You know, they're activists, and they leave Atlanta. There's this huge race riot in 1906, and they leave Atlanta for Brooklyn, actually. Her mother also does something interesting. She is sent to Europe during World War I on behalf of black soldiers there, which is interesting. So she has an interesting beginning. She goes to Smith College. Mm. She gets a BA and an MA at Smith College. She starts out in social work.
So this is in the 1920s or so?
In the 1920s. Yeah, okay. And starts out in social work, but then is determined to become a lawyer. Feels she will be more effective as a lawyer, and she goes to Fordham. And she gets her law degree at Fordham and then ends up working in New York. She has, it sounds like kind of an amazing, interesting career. She's buddies with Eleanor Roosevelt, Mary Bethune, and, you know, other luminaries. You know, she's actually, I think, you know, one of the few women involved in the whole Harlem Renaissance group. So, it sounds interesting. It sounds like a very interesting book to read. I'll be interested to see what reviews are like of it. I think I had one other. Oh, you know, the one thing that she never achieved, she wanted to become a judge. Mm-hmm. And she never managed to do that. But she did not feel it was because of her race or because of her gender. She felt it was because of her brother. Okay. Her brother, Alpheus Hunton, was actually involved with the Council on African Affairs, and he ends up going to jail for contempt of court.
As a communist.
As a communist, yeah, okay. Right. And because he's a communist, and that she feels her link to him.
I would think so.
He ends up living in Africa. He was very involved in, you know, the concept of the relationship between African Americans.
At that time, if
Africa.
You were in association with somebody who was arrested as being a communist, you weren't going to be made a judge.
So anyway, sounds interesting. Stephen Carter and Invisible, his grandmother.
All right. That sounds good. Here's something that something I didn't know. Maybe you knew this. Sounds like you might have known it. But when you're sitting there and you're watching one of these ads, and it's, you know, for the iPhone or something like it, and it comes on with really engaging, zippy music, and you're all charged up about possibly buying the device, and you say, gee, you know, I never heard that song before. That must be a real popular song. I guess I'm no longer following the top songs. Turns out it's not that way. It turns out that a lot of these songs, or parts of songs, or you can call them jingles, whatever you want, it's not a matter of folks scouring the top, you know, the Billboard top list and finding songs that might be
used. This would be cool.
No, they're things that are written for those advertisements. In other words, what you have is an example here is that Sony has something that's called a sync camp. And what they do is Sony has clients, which are people who write music, and they take 17 or 20 of them, and they invite them to a camp in which they're all staying in close proximity to this studio. The folks are invited in to spend a couple days in the studio. They get together, this group of 17. The people running the project for Sony divide them up into teams of three, and we'll say to them something like, we're looking for a particular type of song for a particular commercial or for a particular film. Sometimes the representatives of the brands are there as well. We're looking for this kind of stuff. And they put them in a room, or in this case, five or six separate rooms, and they see what happens. And they see if they come up for something that's a catchy little thing that can be the ad. And then the next day they mix it up. And they mix up the groups
of three. They don't have any copyright problems they pick something that is timely and maybe evokes the feeling of a popular music that everybody knows. Well, so this reminds me of the Brill Building.
Exactly. Right?
The yeah. old-timey right. having this sort of stable of music writers. But here's the other thing. They can't get a computer to do that?
No, apparently not. You need somebody to write the songs. Look, I think it's just amazing enough.
You would think that there's some kind of algorithm you could develop where a computer could... where's our musical expert?
I will say this.
We've got to talk to Mark about this.
I will say this. I think a lot of people who compose songs now do use computers for that.
Yeah.
They use the computers to figure out how to lay down tracks. They use the computers even in generating the songs themselves or figuring out how to orchestrate them. I think the computer does work its way in it. But I don't think it's a push-button thing, let's have a song. I think you need songwriters. And what these folks are aspiring songwriters. And they do get copyrights for whatever they write, but they don't make money like real big-time songwriters. But it's a way for them to get noticed. People do listen to the ads. They track down the YouTube video in which the person who wrote the song actually plays the whole song, if you will, that they just wrote. And they attract more business that way. And sometimes a following that they even become touring pros. So yeah. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that's different about it is for ads, not for orchestras
just,
or whatever.
It's written specifically.
Since time began, somebody's been saying, can you write something like this?
Maybe. Oh, well, but, you know, the myth of the singer-songwriter is that there's somebody in their basement, they're just writing something, and people say, I like the way that sounds, let's record it. But this kind of is engineered the other way, in a purely, you know, commercial way, which I guess is fine.
Right.
News to me.
News to you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we live to, kind of enlighten you.
Apparently.
Anyway, so here's some sad news. Okay. Not to me, but to some people.
Yeah.
Maybe they already have stopped making Tab.
Well, they're still making
the first diet Coca-Cola drink.
Exactly.
That apparently was developed or was first put on the market in 1963.
Right.
Okay, so I have fond memories of Tab. I used to sit in my friend Nancy Ferguson's house. Her refrigerator had an ice maker, and we would have these big bottles of Tab poured over big glasses of ice right out of the freezer. You didn't have to even,
open the
squeeze
freezer.
Them out of the the tray. And I remember many discussions over life and love and grades in high school over Tab.
Well, that's...
Now, it tasted awful.
Yes.
I have not really had it for more than 40 years. And I think I have tried to drink it once in a while and not successfully. Tastes awful. Now, there's this whole article in the New York Times about this, and there are some people who feel that it's the only thing that tastes like Coca-Cola.
Oh, no.
Without
sugar. No one's saying that.
And, it's made with saccharin. And you remember that whole thing
that
about saccharin's going to give you cancer. Well, they never really proved that. And it's still made with saccharin.
Well, actually, I think the Times got that wrong. I think what happened was cyclamates was really identified as the more troublesome product.
I really remember saccharin was an issue.
All right, well, we'll drill down on that. But you're absolutely, first of all, Tab was a huge product. And it was, it was as bigger really than Diet Coke is today. It was the singular diet drink that people drank. And it was a big product.
Until 1982,
when they introduced
Diet Coke.
In their wisdom.
And they said by 2011, they were only making 3 million cases of Tab as opposed to 885 million cases of Diet Coke.
Tab tasted like gasoline if it had been carbonated. And it tasted bad, but on the other hand, it was the only thing out there. And there was no reason. I can't imagine anyone thought it tasted like Coke. It was a cola. It was brown, but it was a different type of thing. But it was clearly a part of the culture.
Quite a bit of it.
And the thought that it might be disappearing is upsetting because it's so much a part of our past. But there you go. Onward and upward. I think that they are continuing to make it. It's distribution that's the issue. But if it was up to the Coca-Cola, they'd stop making it. It's just a headache at this point. So it'll be gone soon enough. So we're going to end with a few obituaries. There are two football obituaries. One is two players who kind of competed against each other. One is a defensive lineman named Dick Modzelewski, who was a big figure in my youth. He was a member of the defensive line of the New York Football Giants in the late 50s and early 60s. And I can tell you without having the article in front of me that the fearsome foursome that the Giants feature them, and what's it sometimes called, that usually associated with the Rams more than the Giants. But in any event, those were four defensive linemen, and I will tell you, it was Andy Robustelli, Dick Montaleschi, Jim Katcavage, and Rosie Greer. And everybody who followed the Giants knew those names. They were considered tremendous football players, and they were. The Giants had great success.
Of course, Rosie Greer was also a great knitter.
He was. But he was also a late replacement for a fellow named John Lopatier. So it's a long story. But,
all right.
But he was quite famous because he played for L.A. before he was on the Giants. In any event, but they were formidable. Montaleschi was formidable, known as Little Mo because he had an older brother who at some point in time was bigger than he was and ended up 80 pounds lighter. But Montaleschi was a star. He was, the Times article talks about his and the Giants competing against Jim Brown and the Cleveland Browns, the great Jim Brown. But as it happens also this week, Jim Taylor passed away. When the Giants were competing in those days, it wasn't just Jim Brown and the Browns, it was Jim Taylor and the Packers. And of course, as great as Jim Brown was, it was the Packers that was the most successful team. Hmm. And Jim Taylor did compete effectively with Jim Brown and one year did win the MVP over Jim Brown. And the difference between Jim Taylor and Jim Brown was that he was a fullback with Paul Hornung at halfback, not a light running back. He was a big, menacing guy. The way they put it then, I guess Vince Lombardi, quote, Jim Brown will give you a leg and then take it away from you. Jim Taylor will give it to you and then ram it through your chest. And he was legendary for running over people, for crushing people. And to me, the most interesting thing about this obituary is it says that Jim Taylor was 6 feet tall and 214 pounds.
So that's not very big.
No, it's shocking.
Oh,
it's
my.
Shocking. I mean,
but he played big.
Or everyone was smaller. I mean, the Giants have one of the fastest players in the league now, Saquon Barkley. He's probably 6'3", 235 pounds or something like that. There have been a lot of running backs who were over 230 who are very fast. There are quarterbacks who are 260 pounds now. He was 6 feet, 214 pounds, and he was one of the most feared players in the league. It just tells you that the league has changed. But in any event, you had another.
Yeah, Sue Hubbell passed away. New York Times describes her as Sue Hubbell, who wrote quietly penetrating books and essays about her life as a beekeeper, curious wanderer, and divorced woman navigating middle age. She died in Maine. And some of her books are A Country Year, Living the Questions, and A Book of Bees and How to Keep Them. All right, she has a pretty, unremarkable youth, I would say. And she goes to Swarthmore College and the University of Michigan before moving to California with her husband, Paul Hubbell. They eventually end up in the East. She gets a degree in library science. She was working in, libraries. They move to Providence, Rhode Island. She's working in Brown University's libraries. And then all of a sudden, boom, not all of a sudden, at a certain point, they decide to drop everything in the 70s and move to, first they take a trip around, a year-long trip around the U.S., then they move to the Ozarks and to just start a life of beekeeping.
Beekeeping, that's
and,
right.
And, you've heard the story a million times. People have, drop out of the rat race. Providence, Rhode Island doesn't sound like so much of a rat race.
Right.
But anyway, they do it. They're not entirely successful. They get divorced. She ends up with the beekeeping
farm. Right, and she has to learn how to be a beekeeper.
And so she has to learn that, A. And B, it's not the most profitable business. So she starts writing.
Yes.
To bring in extra
And she's a
money.
Funny writer. She's a good writer.
Yes.
And that's the thing. And go ahead.
And so she writes about beekeeping, et cetera, but she also is, interested in wandering around and traveling. And one of the good stories in the obituary is how she sets off on Route 60 in search of the best pie, the perfect slice of pie. After sampling pies at diners and cafes in a number of states, she crossed into Oklahoma, where she ends up getting stopped for speeding by the local police. And she said she always had a healthy respect for state troopers and their knowledge of pie. And she, you know, asks the trooper where she can get the best pie. And he says to her, "Sorry, ma'am, but you're in cobbler country now." Okay.
Well, I hope she didn't get a ticket.
Well, who knows? I mean, it's worth... it's worth making that distinction. A pie has a short crust.
Yes.
On the, usually, at least the bottom, maybe on the top too. Cobbler has kind of a biscuit topping. So you have the nice juicy fruit on the bottom and then almost a biscuit topping. Crisp has a nice little crumble. So that's everything you need to know about eating in the fall.
Maybe more.
And I thought... it's a little bit sad but interesting about how she died. In early August of this year, researchers found her disoriented in the woods. Okay, she had wandered away and gotten lost, and she was experiencing the onset of dementia, and she decided she did not want to let the dementia run its course, and imagining the suffering for her and her loved ones. So she decided on the morning of September 9th to stop eating and drinking. And she stuck to that and passed away 34 days later, increasingly lucid, says her son, through the last few days. She saw her... passing and the whole process as a triumph. And what I'd like to end with today is something she said about, you know, part of her writing was waking people up to what's around them every day. And she said, "You don't have to go out to the Ozarks to watch and see things that are interesting," she told the Boston Globe in 1986. "You can look at people going by, pieces of paper blowing. The important thing is to pay attention to what's happening to you wherever you are, to give the present your full attention."
All right. That sounds right.
And so we're going to go off and give the present some attention?
Yeah. Okay. I guess that's right. All right. So
that's it.
That's it for Thompson and Dan Read the Paper. Dan Abuhoff
and Tamsin Granger. See you next week.